Welcome, Missoula. My name is Barbara Thoreau. I have lived in Missoula since 1978. And this has got to be one of the most stressful, the most exciting, the most delightful things that I have worked with. I appreciate criticisms that I've received. I appreciate cooperations. And I appreciate, most of all, the support. I think our lines now are clear back. I was asked to make the announcement that the cameras did need to have the clearing so they could see the stage. It looks like that has happened. I want to welcome those people who are sitting at home on their deck, where I'd like to be, I think, but and tuning in to mtpr.org or mcat.org. We're very glad that they took this opportunity to live stream so that some other people could partake in the conversation. I want to reiterate that this is not a press conference. It's not John Krakauer's conference. It's not Doubleday's conference. It's a Missoula forum. It might not be as public as some people might want. The room's going to get hot. Things will get steamy. But it's what we need at this point. There will be an interview, and I'll briefly introduce the people up here with me. And then after the interview, there won't be a longer second part. There'll be a short kind of introduction of some guests in the audience and to tell you about some of the materials that are available, some of the things that Missoula has worked on during the last 3 years, information that you can pick up, information that will give you more things to talk about and continue the discussion. So with that, let's begin the main event. Up here on the stage, Larry Abramson came to Missoula from Washington, D.C. He's worked for the past 30 years before he came to Missoula with National Public Radio. His last stint with public radio was working as a Pentagon correspondent, where he traveled the world with the Secretary of Defense on the Doomsday plane. I think that might give him some preparation for what's going on. The other person on the stage is John Krakauer. He is an author, most recently of a book called Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. We're here to listen. Let it begin. Thank you.
Sorry, little technical difficulties. So John, why are you here?
Testing.
There we go.
When the book was announced, no one can believe this, but I was pretty surprised that Missoula wasn't happy about the title. And I read in the paper that Barbara, she said she wanted to have a forum to clear the air. And I already negotiated. I don't like doing this, and I don't have to do book tours anymore. Those are part of the things I have enough experience and leverage so I could say no book tour. But it was my idea when I saw that. I felt like I wanted to come here. I wanted to come here and explain, answer questions. Why did I write this book? Why did I call it Missoula? Anything you wanted to ask me. I felt I had an obligation to do that, and that's why I'm here.
John, we have solicited questions from all over town. We've taken questions via email. We've also taken some from the audience here. And I should say that some of the questions I ask will be from people who have stopped me on the street or sent us emails. And so we're trying to filter in as many points of view as we possibly can. And I have to say, the one comment that I've gotten the most, really since even before this forum announced, was, why Missoula? Why did you decide to focus on this town? Since, as you admit, it isn't particularly notable when it comes to high rates of assault or really most of the statistics that would distinguish it from another town.
I mean, I guess this, you know, forgive me for most of you already know this, but I came upon this subject by accident when a young woman, she's now 30, ended up in rehab. This is a woman I've known since she was born. She's like a daughter to me and my wife. And I found out that the source of her troubles, this anxiety, it's not just rehab, it was a place that treated sexual assault, was she had been raped when she was in her mid-teens, young teens, by a young man she trusted. And then later she was raped again by a family friend, someone I know well and trusted, a family friend of hers. And I couldn't believe this, and I saw the trauma it had caused. You know, this trauma had gone on for more than a decade and had gotten worse and worse. And I was literally ashamed that I, A, didn't know that this young woman with whom I'm very close had suffered this trauma, and B, I didn't know that it could be so devastating. And there's no excuse for that. And I set out to remedy my ignorance by doing what I do, which is research. And, you know, if you weren't so clueless as myself, you would have seen this is everywhere. And I quickly recognized that. And I started tracking these publicized rape cases around the country. They're everywhere. You know, Amherst, Florida, Oregon State, where I grew up. There's more than 30 of them probably I was tracking. One of them was Missoula. It was in the news. Gwen Florio, you know, she deserves more credit than anyone for bringing this thing to light. So I was reading her reporting, which I thought was excellent, and one of the cases I was following was Bo Donaldson, who had raped Allison Huguette, who's in the audience tonight. And it was, you know, I was just following it. I didn't know much about it. And then I saw that there was going to be a sentencing hearing, and, you know, I like Montana. I've spent time here. And it was easy. Well, maybe I should go look at this hearing. It was much more appealing than going to Tallahassee, you know, or something like that. So it was literally by chance. It's not like, it was just on a whim. I didn't think it would be fruitful. It was this bitter cold January morning in 2013 when the hearing was finally held. It was postponed a couple times. And I walked in there and I happened to sit down very close to Allison's family by chance. And I was riveted when seeing Allison's dad was the first witness and her friend Keeley and her mom. And she was, I think Allison was like maybe the fifth witness, second to last prosecution witness. And it was unbelievable. I mean, she was so courageous. And I literally wanted to stand up and cheer. She stood up to this very aggressive defense attorney, gave him as good as she got, better. And then and there I thought, wow, I could write a book around this woman. And it happened to be a woman in Missoula. My initial idea was that it would be one case. It'd be a short book, easy to write, one case, wasn't ambitious. And then the more I learned and saw this pattern and saw, you know, all these cases were interconnected. And it was natural to write about more than one case. And I really resisted writing about the Jordan Johnson case because that was a long trial, you know, thousands of pages of trial transcript and pretrial motions. And I didn't see, you know, I didn't actually decide to add that until the book, I imagined the book would, I was hoping it'd be 60,000 words. It seemed like it might not even be that long. That's kind of it's a really short book. And I'd written about that many words, and I said, okay, I'll add the quarterback stuff, the Jordan Johnson stuff, and it'll probably be another 5,000 words. Well, the trial itself was another, you know, I don't know, the book ended up being whatever it is now, 120,000 words. So that's why, I mean, once I started writing about it seemed like a really good choice. It's not an outlier. The problems Missoula has with sexual assault, I think, are very, very typical. The cases I looked at were, I thought, very typical of, for the most part, for acquaintance rape. They're not, you know, black and white for the most part, although Allison's was pretty black and white. There were, you know, good people making bad decisions. There were bad people making bad decisions. It was interesting. It seemed to illustrate the problem in all its complexity. and I decided this book, I wanted to tell the story of acquaintance rape from the victim's point of view. That seemed to be what was lacking. I needed victims to trust me, and I got some really, really courageous women to trust me and let me tell their stories. I needed documentation from the get-go. I knew women are doubted. I needed a paper trail. Stuff that had been adjudicated where there was records was very useful to me. From the get-go, I've been criticized for not interviewing everyone from the college president to I don't know who. My plan from the get-go was not to rely on interviews. The questions I really wanted to ask, the people who I needed to ask wouldn't tell me by law or by ethics. Lawyers can't breach client-attorney privilege. School officials can't breach privacy laws. Law enforcement can't, you know, there's the Criminal Confidentiality Act. So, you know, it wasn't going to do any good to interview, to ask prosecutors or cops or university officials. I needed to get documents. That's what I do. I needed to get confidential documents. And Montana has a really good press shield law. That was very encouraging to me. If I got the documents, I could use them. I might get sued, but, you know, I could use them. I have a good fight.
Did it never occur to you, though, in choosing Missoula and having the name of this town slapped across this book, that some people would be pissed off and feel that they were being picked on or that you didn't care because it's just a small town?
No, it's not. I really honestly thought it wouldn't be a problem. I mean, I thought that, this happened in Missoula. The book is about Missoula. It seemed like weird to think you could somehow give it a title that would spare the town, having to face the scrutiny. And it wasn't, I like Missoula. It's a wonderful town. It doesn't seem like this town would be so defensive. And I was wrong. And I grew up in a small town. I grew up in Corvallis, Oregon. It's like a smaller version of Missoula. And, you know, I get it now that if someone had come to town and written Corvallis, rape in the justice system in a college town, I personally wouldn't have been upset, but I know a lot of people in Corvallis would have been. So I get it. Having said that, I don't regret. I think it's a really good title. It's not sensational. It's almost like an academic paper. It says exactly what it is. It's concise. Missoula, rape in the justice system in the college town. That's a very brief, accurate description. So, I don't know what to say. That's the title. I don't regret it. I'm sorry it caused so much turmoil. I mean, it certainly caused me problems, too. So that's what it is.
Did you ever think about looking at home? Boulder and the University of Colorado have their own sexual assault problems. The school has also faced the same investigation from the Department of Justice that Missoula has. Why not look there? And how would you feel about it if somebody came to Boulder and wrote a book?
I would be glad that if spotlight was shown on Boulder has a terrible problem. I wish someone would write a story about Boulder. I mean, a lot of people think it's unfortunate that Missoula is under such scrutiny, beginning with Gwen. I mean, but actually Missoula has benefited immensely from Gwen bringing Shining. If she hadn't, a number of people told me, if she hadn't done what she did, this problem would still be swept under the rug. I don't know if people appreciate how rare it is for a college town where the college is so big, small town, small newspaper, for a reporter to stand up to the, I mean, football, the money, it's a big thing. And for a paper and a reporter to have the courage to report the truth, in Corvallis, there were scandals and the paper didn't cover because sports writers lose their access. I mean, it's a tough job being a sports writer. If you're a sports writer and you didn't write about this and you knew about it, you should be ashamed of yourself. And Gwen Florio deserves credit. She took so much shit for what she wrote. I mean, it was horrible. It was ugly. I saw it all. And she stood up for it. She didn't whine about it. She just did her job. And she deserves the credit for Missoula is a much safer and better town, despite the embarrassment, thanks to her.
Let's talk a little bit more. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the choices you made about people you were going to talk to. I understand, and you said that you didn't expect to get anything from university officials and some of the people who are described in greater detail in your book. But isn't it, I don't know if you can consider yourself a journalist, or if
absolutely
you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't it a journalistic obligation to call these people and to call them in plenty of time before publication to get
No, that's this. I'm not a beat reporter. I don't. If you are a radio or TV reporter, you need sound bites. You need interviews because that's documents are hard to use in radio. I need to write the truth and make sure it's accurate. I'm also writing a book that the lag between, this was very short, but the lag between completing the book and turning it in on publication is typically 6 to 12 months. And I have, many of the people I wrote about, this did not escape my mind, are very litigious. And I tried to, I stayed under the radar and tried to keep it on the down low. Because if it got out, I didn't know, I have confidential documents. If I had called the prosecutor and asked him for this and that, I worried that, you know, there would be some, if the prosecutor himself sued the DOJ. I didn't want, not want my book stuck in limbo. In fact, you know, when I finished the book, my plan was when I finished to do the interviews that I wanted to do. And it wasn't, I wanted those interviews because I had genuine questions that I really wanted to ask David Paoli, Kirsten Pabst. So I waited until February. The book had just been announced. And before I could call Paoli, the day the book was announced, called my attorney, Mike Malloy, and threatened to sue me. And the next day, he followed up with a letter to Mike Malloy, very thinly veiled threat to sue me again if I didn't show him the book. At that point, a lawyer is going to tell his client, "Do not talk to this guy." With Kirsten Pabst, contrary to what she wrote, on February 19th, I sent her an email. I waited a week. I hadn't heard a reply, so I sent it again and said, "Oh, and by the way, I didn't hear from you, so I've also faxed it." And immediately there was a reply saying, "Have your lawyer call me." I had three questions. The letter was three questions, which she refused to answer. I asked Mike to ask them for me. She wouldn't answer them. She then sent him a not even really veiled threat to sue me. So the two people I had hoped to question most now are off the table because I'm looking at a libel suit. And I want to say, the university, I was really kind of angry when I was reading, when this book was announced and Krakauer hasn't talked to anybody and Ron DeVore's saying he's never talked to me and President Engstrom. In January 2014, I requested from the Commissioner of Higher Education all the information about Jordan Johnson, as you know, the university, there was an adjudication and this was all released and unsealed from a lawsuit that Paoli filed on his client's behalf. We know from that information, which wasn't widely disseminated, but it's in the public domain, that Jordan Johnson was found guilty by the dean of the students. He appealed to the vice president. He was found guilty of raping the woman I call Cecilia Washburn. He appealed again to the university court. Paoli blackballed two of the members because he thought they were biased. The court found him guilty 5-2 and voted 7-0 to expel him. The president signed off on that. Said, "You are expelled. Your college career is over. I'm sorry to tell you." Well, he had one more chance to appeal to the Commissioner of Higher Education. We know he did that, and then the screen goes blank. So I called up the commissioner. I wrote the commissioner and called and said, "I'd like to know what happened when everything went blank. And we cannot even tell you if there was a hearing." Well, wait. These documents say there. You know, these legal documents from this lawsuit. There definitely was an appeal. They would tell me nothing. They stonewalled. I had my lawyer in Colorado make a request. Stonewalled. I had a lawyer. I then was introduced to Mike Malloy, who had to file a petition. A district judge in Lewis and Clark County ruled in my favor. Ordered the commissioner to turn over these records. They're not in violation of FERPA, she said. You're wrong, you're using FERPA as a shield to escape accountability. Well, it's now under appeal to the Supreme Court, and we'll see whether I got them. But the point is that for the university to say, "Well, you never talked to us," why would I talk to you when you won't even tell me if this, you know, if this even happened?
So you don't feel, and I'm here not as a university official, I should have said that I'm here as a journalist and I'm not representing the university. You didn't feel any responsibility just to, in the latter part of your book, you talk a little bit about some of the changes that have been made in policies on reporting sexual assaults and collaboration with the police. You didn't feel a responsibility to talk to them so that they could represent what they feel they've done.
Why? I reported that. All the people in the book, Fred Van Valkenburg, I don't paint him as a villain. I praise him. I criticize him. I'm very careful in this book from everyone. Their own words, their public statements, I give their point of view. I think I have a point of view in this book, but it's balanced. I've given the other side. I don't understand this, I needed to call them and get a comment about, we're improved. I point out in the book that, yeah, they made real changes. So I just don't understand that. I don't buy that. I didn't go to journalism school. I think I'm very ethical, but I don't, I really despise this he said, she said journalism, where it's just like, well, he said, she said, you make up your own mind. I've given, the university, their point of view is well represented in my book, I think. So I did not feel an obligation after I've been shut down with the questions I want to say, no, we're not going to answer that, but let us tell you all the great things we've done to improve the thing we're not going to tell you about. I mean...
The Department of Justice did a study of sexual assaults from 1995 to 2013 and concluded that non-students are more likely to be assaulted than students. So students are not at greater risk than non-students are. Why all of this attention from your book and from different kinds of media all over the country to student sexual assault?
Well, I point out in the first pages of my book that non-students are more likely to suffer sexual assaults than students. But once I started writing about Missoula, if there had been non-students who were on the radar, who were part of this series of assaults, I would have gladly written about them. I didn't go cherry-picking for the right cases. Once I decided about this one case and saw all these problems, I reported what I found. I think I reported it fairly and accurately. So, yeah, there were no non-students, but, I'm sure there are non-students who have been sexually assaulted in Missoula that didn't come on the radar because they're not students, because there's not that, one of the important points I wanted to make in the book is there's this debate out there about should universities even adjudicate rape cases? Well, one, the government requires them to under Title IX, and two, they need to. They can't just turn it over to law enforcement for all kinds of reasons. But because schools are more likely, believe it or not, even though they cover up rapes, to turn up rapes than, the non-students who are turned down by the prosecutor, they have nowhere else to turn. The students, at least, can, if they want, go to the university and try to get some justice there.
So, but does that work? I mean, the military makes the same claim. We have a separate justice system. Sometimes we can kick people out of the military because they've engaged in sex outside of marriage, and so we have a better system. But in the end, do you feel that the university system ends up complementing the legal system, or does it complicate it?
I don't think it complicates it. I think both systems are necessary. And I think the university system across the country is terrible. It needs to, there was a law just passed in the Senate, sponsored by Kirsten Gillibrand, who I met in New York 2 weeks ago. And that is a good first step. It's saying across the country there has to be a standard for schools that works. And it's not going to be easy, but they need to do it. If that happens, schools are and the people adjudicating these cases need to be trained. Schools have to do something. The justice system is not able to investigate quickly and deal with rapists on campus. It needs to be done at a lower burden of proof. So justice system, they're going to sift through the cracks. And universities can't just ignore it. I mean, these serial rapists, we know from the research that, 90% of the rapes are done by serial rapists who rape at least 6 women. So you can't just say, this is too hard. We're going to let these accused rapists stay on campus because we don't know for sure. It's not going to be easy, and you've got to make sure you don't, expel innocent people, and you're going to make some mistakes. But something that drives me crazy is in all these cases, the default is, well, it's too difficult, so we're not going to prosecute. And then what about the victim? What about the... it's so damaging. You think, well, God is so wrong. It's so damaging to be falsely accused. And that's true. It's terrible. And you should avoid that at all costs. But you should also avoid at all costs not convicting a rapist who's guilty, because now you have a victim who was raped and is suffering all that trauma. And on top of that, you're piling on, it's just as much stigma as to be falsely accused. She's being falsely accused of being a liar. And that's at least as damaging as being falsely accused of being a rapist.
So, in light of all this attention from the Justice Department and from reporters like you, universities have moved to this preponderance of the evidence standard, which is lower. And we are already hearing about dozens of lawsuits from accusers who feel that they don't have a chance to defend themselves, that the deck is stacked against them, that they don't really have the right to an attorney in the full legal sense, and that we've basically swung too far in the other direction. What sort of remedy does the university have in dealing with these suits? As you know, a number of law professors at different schools, particularly from Harvard, have protested against the standard that you seem to be supporting.
Well, the problem isn't the standard. The problem is these universities have totally messed up systems for Harvard is one of the worst. I mean, so the answer isn't, oh, we can't adjudicate. Then the answer is get your fucking act together and figure out how. I mean, I'm serious. I'm not. It's like everyone says, oh, Chicken Little, the sky is falling. Well, and also, I think these civil cases are good. These will pressure universities to get their act together. If men have been falsely accused, damn straight they should sue the university. I'm not, some women lie. It's just the number of women lie is such a small proportion of the number of rapists who aren't held accountable that, you know, there has not been an overcorrection. I would bet my life on that. The problem isn't that we're too aggressively going after rapists. We're still not going after them nearly aggressively enough. It's just the system is a mess, and it's not going to be easy, but universities have to figure out a way to do it more fairly. And the preponderance of evidence, that standard, you can't be incarcerated, you're not going to be registered as a sex offender, you're just going to be expelled if you're guilty. Now, you know, the example I use in the book is O.J. Simpson was found innocent, wasn't a great enough burden of proof to find him guilty. And so what did the people who wanted justice do? Ron Goldman sued in civil court, and they won by a preponderance of evidence. And so it's the same kind of thing where preponderance of evidence is the standard for most civil litigation. It's a fine standard for many things, including universities adjudicating rape cases. Yeah, you're gonna have some wrong decisions. The problem is you already have so many wrong decisions the other way. You know, I don't understand this fear. Oh my God, you know, it might be wrong and falsely expel. And I guarantee you're gonna falsely expel an innocent person, and I hope he sues and teaches the school to be more careful. But right now, there's all these rapists who are just walking among the other students. They're not even expelled. I mean, you know, the studies show this. My whole way of thinking about this changed, and it's not going to be easy to get others to think that way too. But I feel passionately about this. I'm not just ranting.
You said that there are false accusations.
Sure.
Did you, in your interviews, come upon any cases where you said, this seems really gray, I don't know whether or not to believe this victim?
No, but I sure, for all the victims I spoke with, I made it clear that, you know, I'm going to report the truth, and I'm going to report what I find out, and you're not going to get to change what I write. And I made it, you know, I began by believing the victim, but, you know, trust but verify. That's what you have to do. There's certainly a lot of these cases. I'm not saying all the cases I wrote about would have been or even should have been, you know, if they'd gone to trial, if the burden of proof was high enough. The burden of proof for criminal cases is really high, beyond a reasonable doubt. That's really high. So I recognize that someone can be guilty of rape and not be found guilty. That's going to happen. So I can't say that all the cases I write about, the rapist deserved to be imprisoned. I think all of them, there was enough, probable cause that they should have been prosecuted. That's a different question.
But you do seem to have a problem with the adversarial process, which is fundamental to the entire legal system, and the fact that it does appear to run roughshod over the rights of victims. What is the remedy for that? We can't if we're going to prosecute, if the prosecutor was going to go after more cases, it's still going to be an adversarial process.
I understand that, and I'm not saying we got to scrap. I don't like the adversarial system, but it is what we've got, and I'm not advocating that we scrap it. What I'm saying is two things, that prosecutors, if they get motivated and understand that when you go after rapists, it's just not one frat boy, it's a serial rapist who's a real threat to the community, so you better put a lot more effort into going after him, and B, educate yourself. You train your prosecutors to understand how trauma changes brain chemistry so you can educate juries, so you can win more cases. You're still going to lose cases. But another thing is, you know, my book, even though in the Cecilia Washburn, Jordan Johnson case, I understand why he was found not guilty. I understand why the defense did a really aggressive, not entirely honest, but a really good job, you know. I understand why that jury didn't convict him. But what I still think is important for people to know that even when the guy is found not guilty, that doesn't mean the victim was lying. I mean, that's a whole other thing. I want people to know that, because a lot of people say, oh, he's found not guilty. We can't believe her. No, look at the facts. Look at what the trial transcript said. You can acknowledge that there wasn't enough burden of proof and still acknowledge, but I, as the juror I spoke with, you know, confidentially, I had an interview with by mail back and forth. I offered to come, and she said, no, let's do it by mail. And she said, well, yeah, I think he probably did rape her, but, you know, the judge, it was all laid out there. We had doubts. There was reasonable doubts. I get that. But I also get that if you look at the evidence, you might decide, man, wait a minute. She texted immediately, oh, my God, I think I just might have been raped. I said no, but he pushed and pushed. I mean, that to me, that's a spontaneous, within an instant of it happening. He confessed at trial that he pinned her arms down, you know, and there was bruising on her chest. So, you know, if I'd been in that jury, I would have voted to find him guilty, but I understand why others didn't. But I think readers need to make up, I want people to look at the evidence and understand that just because a guy was found not guilty doesn't mean the victim lied. That is something that I hope people take away.
So say prosecutors, you know, take your advice, and there's already some indication that there have been many changes made in this town and other places that victims are being heard first and believed, and the examination is going forward under that assumption. Then you may have more cases going to trial and then simply leading to an acquittal if juries aren't convinced. Is that a responsible way to proceed, to have more broken cases like that?
I look at it a very different way. I think it's so irresponsible to let a prosecutor unilaterally decide, you know what, we're not going to win this, we're not even going to try. I think by trying cases, sometimes you're going to lose them. And if you have a victim who's willing to go through that hell, by trying enough of these cases, juries are going to start to be educated. It's all the part of this process. I mean, if you don't ever try, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If prosecutors go, it's just too hard to win, that, you know, that sets up a really bad precedent. I mean, I think
that's a super compelling argument, but you're dealing in a world of limited resources. And when a prosecutor brings a case to trial, that means there's some other crime that they're not able to prosecute.
Bothers me is rape is a serious crime that's not being taken seriously. So, you know, I don't, and again, if prosecutors come to believe, and the research is good on this, that it's not just that one rapist, but he's probably raped other people, and if you go after him, you might actually find out about other crimes, and if you don't go after him, you're letting a serial predator just go run roughshod through your community. So I think that if prosecutors just take it more seriously and devote the resources, I understand there's limited resources, but what else are you going to, this is important to devote the resources to, even if you lose sometimes.
So I have a question that came in via email from Mr. Henry Reich, and he wants to know how you think rape should be prevented in the first place. And I just to add on that you don't deal much with this question of prevention and whether it plays a role in the cases that you were looking at.
No, I intentionally didn't want to, I wanted to keep it focused on you know, the justice system at university and the criminal justice system. So I didn't want to discuss drinking, which is a problem, but it needs to be separated. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to muddy the waters. I mean, and there's prevention by through education. I think one really good way to educate people is to start, you know, giving rapists stiff sentences. You know, when those two football players at Vanderbilt got those long sentences, I guarantee you that made an impression on a lot of football players. I mean, that's...
You think that that would reduce the amount of crime if more...
I don't... I think it might. I think it's a good first step. You know, it's... I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I think if you don't... but I think you have to... Right now, the message to rapists is you can do this and get away with it. That is a message. You know, it's so easy. That's why if you make it harder for rapists to get away with it, I think that might have an impact.
Now, you wrote in your book that swiftly identifying student offenders and preventing them from reoffending, while simultaneously safeguarding the rights of the accused, will be difficult, but it's not rocket science, okay? Do you really believe that? I mean, I've talked to rocket scientists and I've talked to lawyers, and to my mind, being a lawyer and working in the justice system is tougher. That it's not a scientific process. It's a human process.
It is, and it's very difficult. But right now there isn't a system for dealing with it. That's why the first step is to get a unified national system with the cooperation of the federal government, which this new law by Gillibrand will help. I mean, I think, you know, it's like you look at the flip side. If you have a rapist on campus, you have to do something. You have to decide whether, even if you're going to separate him from his victim, you can't just throw your hands up. You have to have a system in place for doing some kind of evaluation. Did this happen? Is the victim credible? And you can do that. I mean, there are ways to do that. It's not going to be perfect. It is going to be very hard to do. But I don't see you have to do something. And, you know, I've heard the argument. One of my critics in a review said, well, you know, universities don't adjudicate murder cases. They turn those over to the police. But that's because the police and prosecutors take murder cases very seriously. I guarantee you, if as many people were murdered on University of Montana or any other campus as are raped, if those numbers were comparable, you know, that it would be a very different approach to rape. I mean, I didn't say that well, but universities... The police don't take rape cases seriously. They take murder cases very seriously. So if there's a murder case, the university doesn't have to worry about, you know, their work has been done for them. It's not being done for them now by the justice system in rape cases.
Right. Now, but hidden in that quote also is the fact that under any circumstances, even with unlimited legal resources, reporting a rape to the police by a victim is going to be horrible. And I know we have some people here who know that firsthand, and I obviously cannot imagine what that's like. It's never going to be a satisfying experience, and I think your book backs that up. So there's always going to be a disincentive for the main witness in these cases to come forward.
Yes, but if witnesses start seeing that they're going to be taken seriously by law enforcement, that their cases, the prosecutors will actually take them seriously and not just, oh, you're just a drunk girl, then I suspect you'll get more reports. I mean, the disincentive to report now is so high because, you know, the odds of anything good coming of it are so small. If the system slowly reforms and you see that, wow. I mean, you know, I've heard anecdotally from shared emails that things are so much better in Missoula. Victims, I've seen emails from victims who say, you know, thank you for writing this book. I was treated so well by the Missoula Police Department, by the Missoula prosecutors now. I mean, they really did a good job. I mean, Gwen Florio deserves the credit for that, not me. But I think there is a direct correlation between exposing a light on this problem and, you know, a change in the way police and prosecutors operate.
Now, I've talked to victims for some of the stories that I did, and many of them said they did not want their perpetrator to go to jail. That wasn't the answer for them. They wanted something else. In the case of the military, they might want to just be transferred. And they didn't want to go through that process. As you say, the role of the victim in these cases is kind of ambiguous. They're not bringing charges, but they're essential to the case.
Man, I disagree with that. I think this book shows that. Sure, some victims do not want to But one point, I didn't know this before I wrote this book, victims do not get the option to bring charges. It's not up to them, it's up to the prosecutor. They have to convince the prosecutor and fight the prosecutor in many cases to not just file charges. I mean, Allison's case, where you couldn't ask for a case that was more of a slam dunk. 3 recorded confessions, you know, pleading guilty, and to try to convince the prosecutors to actually put him in prison as opposed to give him a slap on the wrist, just, she had to fight tooth and nail. She was re-traumatized by it. So I don't think, the onus isn't on the victims here. The onus is on the system, so that victims feel more, you know, like they're not gonna be on trial. That's, I think, if you start doing that, then I think more victims will report. I mean, more women are reporting anyway. There's this long before this book came out, victims were starting to say, you know what, I'm not gonna be silent anymore. I have nothing to be ashamed of. And it's this, you know, movement across the country of women speaking out, using their real names. And I think that's huge. That's gonna make a difference.
Did you have any concern that your book would scare some victims away from reporting by reading about the experience of some of these women had, and that it seemed to be hopeless, according to some of them?
I didn't think like that. I thought was, this is the problem, and someone needs to shine a bright light on it, and I think it's good. I've heard a lot from a lot of victims who said, thank you for, you know, exposing. I had to go through that too, so I didn't see it as scaring them away, as having some sense of someone's actually acknowledging what we've been going through. So, you know, I guess I just didn't think like that. It's not like, well, should I not report this? I mean, I never thought that. It was like, wow, I need to report this.
So a quick look through Amazon shows there are a lot of books written about rape. Mm-hmm. People have been writing about rape for a really long time, and they've been writing about it from the victim's perspective, perhaps not to the degree that you did, for decades. And is it ironic or strange that you come along, a guy, and you write a book, and suddenly it seems to be getting an inordinate amount of attention? And does that make you feel uncomfortable? Does it show that people only pay attention to these problems when a big name author points to it?
I don't know. I mean, I wrote this for personal reasons. So it's not like, I've talked to feminists who are kind of pissed off, like, why did it take a guy to, and I don't know how to answer that, except I don't regret writing it. There've been a lot of good books written by victims. It's unfortunate that those haven't gotten attention. They should. If this brings attention, great. If it doesn't, I mean, this book's only been out 2 weeks, so it's doing well right now. It might be forgotten in 6 months, you know, I don't know. I mean, so, you know, I'm glad it's getting attention, but it's not like I had any control over that. I mean,
no,
really.
I wonder if you think it's a sad statement, though.
Oh, it is a very sad statement, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You've said that you have a lot of material that you didn't use in this book. Can you tell us anything about where some of that material might have led you, what sort of conclusions it came to, it would have led you to, and why you chose not to use some of that?
I chose not to use it because I couldn't corroborate it, and it'd be irresponsible to talk about it. If I thought I had enough reason to believe it's true, I would have put it in the book. So I'm not going to go there. I left it out of the book, a lot of stuff out of the book, because, you know, I've been wrong. I learned my lesson as a young journalist. I've had to retract stuff that I was absolutely sure was right. I'd gotten from multiple sources. This is in the Tillman book. I accused a guy named Jim Wilkinson of being the architect of the Jessica Lynch cover-up. And my sourcing was impeccable, but it wasn't first-hand sourcing. It was this game of telephone. And he called me up like a couple years after the book was published and said, you're wrong. And I said, no, I'm not. And I listed my sources. Yes, you're wrong. Let's meet. And within 10 minutes of meeting, he convinced me I was wrong. And I retracted it. So I have learned that, man, you know, you need to be really careful about your fact checking. You know, I've already found 2 mistakes in this book that have been corrected and are already in the ebooks. One, Gwen Florio pointed out that I attributed a quote from Coach Flugrad to her that was really attributed to a colleague of hers. Fritz Neighbor, and so that's been changed. David Paoli in the paper pointed out another mistake for which I'm grateful, that I had said that after Jordan Johnson, after his appeal, after it was reversed by Dean Voorhees' ruling, that the victim had no chance to appeal, and he pointed out, well, she did appeal, and I didn't know that, and that's been corrected. So what I'm saying is that it's really hard to get stuff right, and even when you're absolutely sure you make mistakes, so by, you know, Stuff's not in the book because I'm not absolutely sure, so you know, I don't. It would be a mistake to talk about that speculatively now.
Mr. Pelley called me to remind me that this detail about when the last appeal was for the Cecilia Washburn case, that it was still in the print copy of the book. So even though you have the possibility to correct it in the ebook, there are still lots of copies out there.
There are, and you know, and I don't know what else to do. In the next printing, it'll be fixed. You know, mistakes are happening. Good newspapers and good authors correct them. And I will do that. There will be more mistakes, I guarantee you. I hope they're not big ones. But Paley was absolutely right. I mean, I inferred something. In that particular case, I'm going to go back to that for a moment, because another thing that the university really pissed me off is that after we won in district court and Judge Seeley said, you know what, you didn't violate FERPA. Commissioner, turn over the records. Well, the commissioner's spokesman, Kevin McRae, I think his name is, went in the paper and said, we can't turn over these records. The university is going to lose millions of dollars. That was his phrase. Which was, what he didn't say was that a year and a half earlier, when Johnson appealed to the commissioner and was convinced, the commissioner bought the argument of Johnson's attorney that this preponderance of evidence standard isn't fair, even though that's been mandated by the government. He said, you got to do it by a higher standard, clear, convincing evidence. Well, if you decide to do that, the government made it clear, you run the risk of losing all your funding, just like with FERPA. That didn't seem to deter the commissioner when losing all the funding. He ignored the government then and said, no, we don't care about that. You know, we're going to reverse this. And then when I want to reveal that he did that, we can't reveal that because we might lose our funding. So there's this incredible hypocrisy at the university that is FERPA, the Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act, is used. It has some good purposes, protecting student privacy, but is also misused by colleges coast to coast to cover up wrongdoing, exactly the kind of thing that I'm trying to find out what the commissioner did. How did this quarterback, who was found guilty by all these levels, and then it went to the commissioner, and he reversed it, and he said, no, you got to adjudicate it by this higher standard, clear and convincing. So the university says, okay, we'll hire this absolutely independent evaluator, re-adjudicate, reinvestigate the whole case by this higher standard. They did that. That investigator said, yeah, Jordan Johnson isn't credible. He's guilty by this higher standard. And then the Dean Voorhees just said, nope, I don't buy it, and reversed it. All that's been kept secret. No one knows about that. I've told you everything I know because I haven't seen records. All that stuff's from public records. What I want to know and have asked to get is, well, wait a minute, where are the emails flowing between these big grizz boosters and the commissioner? And who influenced Ron DeVoorhees? Who influenced the commissioner? This stuff needs to be known.
So I told you what the most asked question of when people were approaching me and knew that I was going to be speaking with you. But the second most asked question is, where did he get this name Grizzlyville? Because nobody...
No, I know, it's Zootown. The only people who use that are sports writers. That's where I got it, Missoulian sports writers. So it's a stupid name, but don't blame me.
I don't know, I think we're hearing a lot of dissent out there.
Go in the Missoulian and search Grizzlyville, okay?
I don't know. I know Wrigleyville, but I don't know Grizzlyville. But anyway, that's a small point, but a lot of people asked about it. So the University of Montana says it's made a lot of changes. The Missoula police have made a lot of changes. The county prosecutors say they've made a lot of changes. And in fact, they held a news conference last week. I don't know if you had a chance to listen in on that. And they recited a lot of statistics that show that reporting is up, as you said, that more women are going through with the prosecution of crimes against these victims. Would you send your daughter to the University of Montana?
Absolutely. I don't think if I'd send her anywhere. I mean, I think University of Montana now is safer than most other schools. And I think these changes that you're talking about are very real and they're significant, they're important. So from the get-go, I'm trying to make this point. Missoula is actually better than most places, and yet you have this big problem. And so, sure. And now Missoula has gone a long way towards fixing that problem, and that's something to be proud of. I totally believe that. I haven't seen the hard facts, but I've heard enough anecdotal evidence to totally believe that.
Yeah. And as you know, this is an area where it's very difficult to prove that the numbers really show that these efforts are working, right? Because reports go up, it could be because the crimes are, the number of crimes are going up. Reports go down, it could be because more women
But I've heard enough anecdotal reports from victims, from detectives, that, you know, either firsthand or second and third hand, detectives had said, you know what, we're better detectives now. We were good before, better than we got credit for, but we've learned stuff. And so I believe it. I think it's been significant.
You talk a lot in your book about the stigma of reporting a crime like this in a small town, how difficult it is to maintain anonymity, that things that might actually protect a victim's identity in a big city just don't really apply here. Is it possible, since you also live in a small town, is it possible to receive the kind of justice in an environment like this where everybody knows one another under any circumstances?
I think it's possible to receive justice. I think that it's, you know, victims know themselves that their names are going to be out there on the internet, among their friends. I mean, in a small town. Allison Huguette, you know, after she was raped by her best friend since first grade, he spread all these rumors that it was consensual, and so many people in their circle of friends, which became this a lot of the Missoula, believed him. And so she had to face that kind of, you know, those slurs everywhere she went. So, yeah, so it takes courage to do what she did. It takes real courage. And those are the heroes. You know, the victims who come forward are the heroes.
So, I have a couple more questions from people who emailed in. A woman named Kelly McGuire wants to know whether Krakauer and his publisher will be donating any of the proceeds from the book sales to organizations in Missoula doing work to prevent or respond to sexual violence?
I can't answer that because I believe that making donations is something personal. And if I have made donations, it's been for personal reasons, and it would seem really sleazy to try to, you know, curry favor, or I'm just not going to deal with that.
Claire Francoeur, who's I think you know from your book, from First Step, wants to know, upon the next printing of your book, would you consider adding an addendum that includes resources for victims of sexual assault?
I would. Actually, there already is resources. If you go to the Doubleday website, there's a list of several resources for victims. I didn't include in this book because it didn't really occur to me. You know, I didn't want to just put local Missoula resources, but that's a good idea, and that can easily be done.
Okay. And did you at any point consider talking about rape culture and what leads to these crimes in the first place? There's another thing a lot of people have been struck by is the feeling that they were reading about the world that was very foreign to them, that people were taking risks and behaving in ways that they couldn't remember anyway from their own.
No, and that's a, I thought about it. I made a very conscious decision in this book not even to mention the word rape culture. It's not in the book. I wanted to keep it focused on the victims. This is what it's like to be a victim. I didn't, as soon as you start mentioning the word feminism or rape culture, you bring in all this noise all from all these haters. And I didn't talk about alcohol much. I wanted to keep it focused, you know, and that the book suffers from that, but it gains from that. It doesn't pretend to be this. I don't talk about the history of rape, which is fascinating. If you guys want to learn about the history of rape, and it's a book that's been terribly maligned because it's over the top and very political. It's Susan Brown Miller's Against Our Will, published, I think, in 1976. It is an absolutely horrifying book that I think, you know, you can argue about it, but that it's reporting on the history of rape is chilling and accurate, you know, and I guess I'm saying there's better books than I could write that have been written about rape culture, about the history of rape. This book is something different. A lot of the criticism is from understandably people who wanted the book to be something it's not. It is what it is. It has its limitations. It's the best I could do, but it was a very conscious effort to keep it focused on this town, these victims, what they went through. You know, one woman, my publisher showed me, she'd been wondering, why didn't I talk about tonic immobility? This thing where part of trauma, you know, some victims just freeze. They can't do anything. And I understand that's real. I didn't write about it because it didn't afflict, true tonic immobility didn't afflict the victims, I think, that I wrote about. There's a lot of things I didn't write about that are worth writing about, but to keep the focus, I left them out of the book.
Some of the victims you talked to received abuse, some threats. Have you received any?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but I've received death threats for into thin air. I mean, I'm not kidding. Bomb threats, the FBI had to be called. I mean, I've received death threats for into the wild. I mean, so I'm used to it. It's the way, it's the culture we live in now, you know. I take them seriously, or I would. I haven't gotten any yet from this book. But if one is serious, if someone threatens my wife or people I know, I know people in the FBI, and they're going to hear about it. I guarantee you.
Now, as you said, you're continuing to pursue this court case over the Jordan Johnson documents about how the university conducted his expulsion order. What will happen with that once the decision is actually announced? Will you publish a separate article? Will you do a revision of your book?
Well, for most of my books, when I get new information, I publish appendixes, addendums. There's a new edition of Into the Wild. It's 19 years old with some new stupid stuff I found out about the seed. So I like doing that. And so if I win this case at the Supreme Court, you bet there's going to be an addendum, a long one. But even before that, if I win this case, those thousands of pages of records I want, and they probably won't be released all at once. Mike Malloy has said, well, you know, they're going to fight you tooth and nail every little batch they release. But they will be released, and every other journalist in the state is going to have at them, and I think that's great. So, you know, they're going to report that stuff, too, and that's all good. So the stuff, if I win, it's not like no one's going to hear about it. It's going to be out there, and I think it needs to be out there.
Among the feedback that you've gotten from people, did you hear from any accused perpetrators, people who felt like they were unjustly accused? And
what? Absolutely. I've heard people who said, you got it wrong, I was falsely accused. And several of them said, great, send me the stuff, and if you're falsely accused, I'll take it on. But then it turns out the guys who talked to me, I'm not convinced they were falsely accused. I have no doubt there are people out there who are in prison right now who are falsely accused of rape, and that's a travesty and a tragedy. I don't deny that. What I'm saying is, for every one of those guys, there's at least 100 women who were raped, and their rapist walked away laughing. I mean, that's what I'm saying. So that's a problem, but it's a much bigger problem, and we can't ignore that problem, but we are ignoring the much bigger problem. That's the point I'm trying to make here. I'm not saying that, you know, there's not injustice and people aren't falsely accused. In the book, I list a couple of examples. I don't deny that.
Okay. Jan Krakauer, we want to thank you for all the time you devoted and for coming to Missoula. We really appreciate it. Ask your question.
Okay, good. I've got the question.
Ask.
One of these was new.
Just ask it. Don't.
You said, I am a journalist. My point of view in this book is balanced. Last week in the salon.com of April 15th, in an article entitled Rolling Stone Has a Lot to Answer For.
Get a microphone, Joe.
Thomas Dove, D-O-V-E. I am a resident of Missoula. I'm an attorney of 44 years experience, 30 as a prosecutor, none of them in Montana. I notice you pride yourself, as I saw on your website, of being a feminist.
Will you ask your question?
Yeah, oh, just give me some background. People want to identify myself. Okay. You said today, I am a journalist. My point of view in this book is balanced.
I said I have a point of view. The facts are balanced.
No, you said your point of view.
Well, then I stand corrected.
Secondly, last week on Salon, what are some of the challenges peculiar to reporting about rape? And your answer is, part of it, at least in my case for this story, is that I'm not unbiased. I went into it wanting to believe that what these victims said was true.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, did you engage in confirmation bias, such as the Columbia School of Journalism?
I absolutely, yes. I was very conscious of that. That's why I didn't just trust victims' words. You think there's not corroboration? Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm saying, did you engage in confirmation bias?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. My question was, in the same article, Rolling Stone Has a Lot to Answer For, in the Salon interview, at page 8 of that, and also at page A8 of the Missoulian, you said, quote, I have all of these audio and written recordings of university investigations and police interrogations. I am not supposed to have this stuff, and I...
I think in the interest of fairness, we're going to cut this off.
I'm asking him a simple...
You can find another way to submit your question.
People are really... No, okay, please, answer me right now. I said I'm not supposed to have this stuff, and I can't say how I got it.
Take that away and just answer face-to-face, and I'll tell you.
It's a public forum. Because I'm not supposed to have this stuff, and I can't say how I got it, and it's still much more valuable than an actual interview. Did you in fact violate state and federal law? Okay, how did you get it?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate all of your patience. If you would like to exit, all of the doors are open now and you can exit at any time. Thank you so much for coming and have a safe trip home.